Keep in mind that almost 14% of those surveyed told us they inherited their wealth. What happens when we break out inheritors and self-made millionaires? Self-made millionaires spend significantly less for suits, as well as for most other high-status items, than do those who have inherited their wealth. The typical self-made millionaire paid about $360 for a suit, while the typical inheritor of wealth reported paying more than $600. How can the Johnnies of America get away with spending such modest amounts? Johnny does not need to wear expensive suits. He's not a successful attorney who must impress his clients. Nor does he ever have to impress a large audience of stockholders at an annual meeting, the financial press, or investment bankers. Johnny does not have to dress the part of a high-powered CEO who must constantly address a highbrow board of directors. Johnny does, however, need to impress his staff of janitors. How? By never giving them the impression that he is making so much money, he can afford to have a tailor fit him for a suit priced in the low to mid four figures. Most of the millionaires we have interviewed over the past 20 years have views similar to Johnny's. Then who purchases all those expensive suits? Our survey has revealed an interesting relationship. For every millionaire who owns a $1,000 suit, there are at least six owners who have annual incomes in the $50,000 to $200,000 range, but who are not millionaires. Their shopping habits certainly have something to do with the fact that they are not wealthy. Who are these people? Typically, they do not own their own businesses. They are more likely to be corporate middle managers, especially those who are part of a working couple, attorneys, sales and marketing professionals, and physicians. Why would anyone suggest that you spend more than the typical millionaire for a suit? In a recently published article entitled, "You're Looking Rather Prosperous, Sir," by Lawrence Menard in Forbes, an owner of very expensive suits touted that they were an excellent investment. Mr. Menard asks and answers the question of questions about investing in suits. Can custom-made suits be worth $2,000? Mine are. 14 years and 14 pounds later, they still look good. Believe it or not, I made an excellent investment. Mr. Menard tells his readers how he was initially guided to the custom tailor shops of London's Savile Row by two senior-level executives whom he regarded as having excellent taste but were not frivolous in their buying habits. He writes, "They explained that to buy bespoke is to enter into a unique and personal relationship with your clothes." What is the meaning of bespoke? In middle-class American, it means custom-made. Johnny Lucas never bought a custom-made suit. Does he have a unique and personal relationship with his all-wool top-of-the-line JCPenney suit? Are you surprised to learn that some millionaires shop at Penney's? Perhaps even more surprising, about 30.4% of the respondents who are millionaires hold JCPenney credit cards. Penney's private brand Stafford Executive Suits were recently given top scores for durability, cut, and fit by a leading consumer publication. An article in the Wall Street Journal by Terry Agins called "Why Cheap Clothes Are Getting More Respect," notes, "JCPenney now subjects garments to tough tests for color matching, fabric shrinkage, and pilling. When it comes to quality control, Penney's is more demanding than any of the department stores." Keep in mind that moths, cigar ashes, and other hazards do not care how much you paid for your wool suit. They do not understand the full meaning of bespoke. They are not interested in the fact that a suit with the same label was also worn by Dickens, De Gaulle, and Churchill. Nor do they care if your suits ever generate dividends or capital gains. But they can certainly ruin your investment portfolio of suits. Then certainly footwear. Let us return to our proposed TV program. Mr. Lucas is still on stage. What type of shoes does Johnny Lucas purchase? The TV audience, if any are still tuned in, will again be surprised by his answer. Johnny, like most millionaires, does not buy high-priced footwear. About half the millionaires surveyed reported that they had never spent $140 or more for a pair of shoes. One in four had never spent more than $100. Only about one in ten had spent over $300. If not millionaires, then who is keeping the high-priced shoe manufacturers and dealers in business? Certainly, some millionaires purchase expensive shoes. But for every millionaire in the highest price-paid category of over $300, there are at least 8 non-millionaires. But what does the popular press tell us? The press sensationalizes that very small proportion of Americans who purchase expensive shoes and related artifacts. Consider this news story by Jeff Schultz in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution about boxing promoter Don King, who spent 2 hours shopping for shoes in Atlanta. During that time, Mr. King purchased 110 pairs of shoes from one store, for which he paid $64,100, tax included. His purchase topped the previous sales record for the store held by Magic Johnson, who spent $35,000 during one visit. Mr. King's record purchase translates into an average of $582.73 per pair. How much did Mr. King pay for his most expensive pair? It was reported that a pair of alligator loafers cost him $850. Note that only 1% of the millionaires in our survey paid $667 or more for a pair of shoes. Mr. King's purchase of alligator shoes is rare even among millionaires. Nonetheless, the popular media enjoy touting abnormalities in buying behavior. As a consequence, our youth are told that buying expensive items is normal behavior for affluent people. They are led to believe that the wealthy have a high consumption lifestyle. They learn that hyperspending is the main reward for becoming affluent in America. Why does Johnny Lucas get ignored while Mr. King receives headlines? Because Johnny's consumption habits are mundane. His rewards are more intangible than product-related. Financial independence, discipline, and being an excellent family provider, a fine husband, and a father of well-disciplined children. The last chance for Mr. Lucas. Is there any life remaining for our proposed TV program about America's typical millionaire? Can Johnny Lucas still rally and bring back the audience he lost? Johnny Lucas, the affluent business owner, is very punctual. He's never late for meetings and arrives at work each day at 6:30 a.m. How does he do this? It must be his wristwatch. Could it be that Johnny wears an expensive watch? By now, you have probably guessed the answer. And once again, the audience is disappointed. Fully one half of the millionaires surveyed never in their lives spent more than $235 for a wristwatch. About 1 in 10 never paid more than $47, while about 1 in 4 spent $100 or less. Certainly, some millionaires purchase expensive watches, but they are in the minority. Even among millionaires, only 25% of those surveyed paid $1,125 or more. About 1 in 10 paid $3,800 or more. About 1 in 100 paid $15,000 or more. Johnny would, we are sure, apologize to the TV audience for his mundane taste in clothing and jewelry, but we are sure that he would also define his position by reporting the following. I live in a fine home, but have no mortgage. All my children's college accounts were more than fully funded before they even began attending college. Unfortunately, Johnny's story, including his apology, will never get into syndication. So rare the Johnny Lucases. Why are so few people in America affluent? Even most households with six-figure annual incomes are not affluent. These people have a different orientation than does Johnny Lucas. They believe in spending tomorrow's cash today. They are debt-prone and are on earn-and-consume treadmills. Too many of them, those who do not display abundant material possessions are not successful. To them, non-display-oriented people, like Johnny Lucas, are their inferiors. Johnny Lucas is not likely to be held in high regard by many of his neighbors. On a social status scale, he is below average. But on what criteria? In his neighbor's eyes, Johnny has low occupational status. He is an owner of a small business. What happens when he occasionally comes home in one of his janitorial vans? The van stays in his driveway until he leaves the next morning. What are his neighbors to think? They do not know that Johnny is financially independent. They don't give him points for being married and never divorced, fully funding his children's college tuition, employing several dozen people, having integrity, being frugal, paying off his mortgage, and so forth. No, many of his neighbors would prefer that Johnny move out of the neighborhood. Why? Perhaps it's because he and his family don't look affluent. dress like the affluent, drive the vehicles of the affluent, or work in high-status positions. Playing great defense. The affluent tend to answer yes to three questions we include in our surveys. 1. Were your parents very frugal? 2. Are you frugal? 3. Is your spouse more frugal than you are? This last question is highly significant. Not only are the most prodigious accumulators of wealth frugal, their spouses tend to be even more frugal. Consider the typical affluent household. Nearly 95% of millionaire households are composed of married couples. In 70% of these households, the male contributes at least 80% of the income. Most of these men play great offense in the game called income generation. Great offense, in economic terms, means that a household generates an income significantly higher than the norm, which in America is an annual realized income of approximately $33,000. Most of these households also play great defense. That is, they are frugal when it comes to spending for consumer goods and services. One frugal, high-income producer within the married couple category, however, does not automatically translate into a high level of net worth. Something else must be present. A self-made millionaire stated it best when he told us, "I can't get my wife to spend any money." Most people will never become wealthy in one generation if they are married to people who are wasteful. A couple cannot accumulate wealth if one of its members is a hyper-consumer. This is especially true when one or both are trying to build a successful business. Few people can sustain profligate spending habits and simultaneously build wealth. Ode to his frugal wife. How did the wife of a millionaire respond when her husband gave her $8 million worth of stock in the company he recently took public? According to her husband of 31 years, she said, "I appreciate this. I really do." Then she smiled, never changing her position at the kitchen table, where she continued to cut out 25 and 50 cents off food coupons from the week's supply of newspapers. Nothing is so important as to interrupt her Saturday morning chores. She just does today like she always has done, even when all we owned was a kitchen table. It's how come we're well off today. Made a lot of trade-offs, sacrifices early in our marriage. Why aren't you wealthy, you ask? Well, let's examine your lifestyle. Is it one of great offense? Are you in the $70,000, $100,000, $200,000 income category? Congratulations, you play wonderful offense. But how is it that you keep losing the game called wealth accumulation? Be honest with yourself. Could it be that you play terrible defense? Most high-income earners are in the same situation, but not most millionaires. Millionaires play both quality offense and quality defense, and quite often their great defense helps them outscore or out-accumulate those who out-earn or have superior offenses. The foundation stone of wealth accumulation is defense. And this defense should be anchored by budgeting and planning. We have discovered that several occupational groups contain large numbers of budgeters and planners. Affluent auctioneers. Our latest survey of auctioneers found that more than 35% of them are millionaires. This percentage is slightly higher than the proportion of millionaire households living in America's finest urban and suburban neighborhoods. Auctioneers have been on our list of highly productive types since we conducted our first study of occupations in 1983, when they ranked sixth among those with realized annual incomes of more than $100,000. But their income alone was not what caught our attention. Given the same level of income, who accumulates more wealth? An auctioneer residing in small-town America, or someone who lives in a high-status urban or suburban neighborhood? As you can guess, it is the typical auctioneer. Auctioneers are more frugal than their high-income producing counterparts in prestige areas. They have lower overhead both for household and business expenditures. To some extent, these data are explained by the lower cost of living and doing business in small towns. Yet even when cost of living is taken into account, auctioneers are more prone to accumulate wealth. Consider the following. On average, millionaire auctioneers are about 50 years of age, 6 to 8 years younger than their urban or suburban counterparts. The average millionaire auctioneer spends only 61% of the amount urban or suburban millionaires allocate for housing. Urban or suburban millionaires are more than three times more likely than millionaire auctioneers to own luxury foreign automobiles. Auctioneers hold a higher proportion of their wealth in appreciating assets than do other high-income producers, and they invest in categories in which they have expertise. Auctioneers have experience with bankruptcy. They are aware that consumer goods often generate few cents on the dollar. One auctioneer explained why she was so frugal. "When I was quite young, I watched a woman crying, sitting on a chair in her front yard. All the while, bidders were walking away with everything she once owned. I'll never forget that woman." Let's ask the typical American self-made millionaire about her defense. We will refer to her as Mrs. Jane Rule. Mrs. Rule and her husband own a small business, an auctioneering and appraising company. They also invest in several of the categories of items they appraise. Mr. Rule is the visible manager of their business. He gets much of the credit for its success. After all, he speaks very well and very quickly. But it's actually Mrs. Rule who is the true force, the real leader of this enterprise. It's her planning, designing, budgeting, bill collecting, and marketing that made this auctioneering company successful. Why are Mr. and Mrs. Rule millionaires today? Because Mrs. Rule plays tremendous defense. She is responsible for budgeting and spending for both her household and their business. Is anyone in your household responsible for budgeting? All too often the answer is, not really. All too often people allow their income to define their budgets. When we tell our audiences about the budgeting and planning habits of the affluent, someone always asks a predictable question. Why would someone who is a millionaire need to budget? Our answer is always the same. They became millionaires by budgeting and controlling expenses, and they maintain their affluent status the same way. Sometimes we are forced to add analogies to make our point. We ask, for example, have you ever noticed those people whom you see jogging day after day? They are the ones who seem not to need to jog, but that's why they are fit. Those who are wealthy work at staying financially fit, but those who are not financially fit do little to change their status. Most people want to be physically fit, and the majority know what is required to achieve this. But despite that knowledge, most people never become well-conditioned physically. Why not? Because they don't have the discipline to just do it. They don't budget their time to just do it. It is like becoming wealthy in America. Oh, you want to, all right, but you play lousy financial defense. You don't have the discipline to control your spending. You don't take the time to budget or plan. Note that under-accumulators of wealth spend three times as much time exercising per month as they do planning their investment strategies. Mrs. Rule is different. She's like most millionaires. She's disciplined. She takes time to plan and budget. This translates into wealth. Mrs. Rule's household income varies from year to year. It is typical for auctioneers to have ups and downs in their cash flow. Often, downturns in our nation's economy translate into increased demand for auctioneering services. Over the past 5 years, her annual income averaged around $90,000. But her net worth keeps increasing. Today, Mrs. Rule has a net worth of more than $2 million. In our survey, she answered yes to four questions about planning and budgeting. Do you wish to become affluent and stay affluent? Can you answer yes, candidly and honestly, to these four simple questions? Question 1. Does your household operate on an annual budget? Do you plan your consumption spending according to a variety of food, clothing, and shelter categories each year? Mrs. Rule does, and so do most millionaires. In fact, in our latest national survey of millionaires, we found that for every 100 millionaires who don't budget, there are about 120 who do. We anticipate your question about these millionaires who don't budget. How did they become millionaires? How do they control spending? They create an artificial economic environment of scarcity for themselves and the other members of their household. More than half of the non-budgeters invest first and spend the balance of their income. Many call this the pay-yourself-first strategy. These people invest a minimum of 15% of their annual realized income before they pay the sellers of their food, clothes, homes, credit, and the like. What about those millionaires who don't budget or create an environment of relative scarcity? Some inherited all or most of their wealth. Another minority, accounting for fewer than 20% of millionaires, typically earn such high incomes that to some extent they can eat their income and still have a seven-figure net worth. In other words, their extraordinarily good offense compensates for a lack of defense. But so what if you earn $2 million a year and have a net worth of $1 million? Technically, you're a millionaire, but spiritually, you're an under-accumulator of wealth. And it's likely that your millionaire status is temporary. These are the people you read about in the newspaper. The press loves to tout freaks of both nature and economics. Will the popular press ever do a story on Mrs. Rule? It's unlikely. Who wants to read about Mrs. Rule's $140,000 home or her four-year-old Detroit metal sedan? Who wants to see her sitting at the kitchen table three nights in a row putting together her family's annual budget? Is there anything exciting about computing and accounting for each dollar spent last year? Would you be thrilled to watch Mrs. Rule compute and allocate future dollars of income into dozens of consumption categories? How long could you stand to watch her carefully complete her annual allocations calendar? Well, it's not fun for Mrs. Rule either. But in Mrs. Rule's mind, there are worse things, such as never being able to retire and never being financially independent. It's much easier to budget if you visualize the long-term benefits of this task. Question 2. Do you know how much your family spends each year for food, clothing, and shelter? Almost two-thirds of the millionaires surveyed, 62.4%, answered yes to this question. So did Mrs. Rule. But only about 35% of high-income-producing non-millionaires answered yes to this question. Many of these high-income, low-net-worth types have no idea how much they spend each year for such items as food consumed at home, food consumed away from home, beverages, birthday and holiday gifts, each category of clothing for each household member at each store, babysitters, daycare fees, line of credit use, charitable contributions, financial advice, club dues, motor vehicles and related expenses, tuition, vacations, heating and lighting, and insurance. Notice that we did not include mortgage payments in our list. Often, high-income, low-net-worth respondents boast about how much money they save on taxes via their mortgage deductions. Certainly, most millionaires who have mortgages outstanding also take advantage of this provision. But most millionaires also account for their other categories of domestic expenditures. Ask typical high-income, low-net-worth people about their goals. What will they tell you? A major goal they often name is to minimize their tax burden. They use the mortgage deduction as a way to accomplish this. Then why don't these same people compute their other domestic expenditures? Simply because they do not perceive any value in doing so. As they see it, most of their domestic spending is not deductible in computing one's taxable income. But Mrs. Rule sees things differently. Her goal is to become financially independent. In her case, to have $5 million by the time she and her husband retire. She believes that budgeting and accounting for domestic consumption is directly related to achieving this goal. In her view, tabulating helps control consumption. It also reduces the probability of allocating too many dollars to product and service categories that are not really important. Mrs. Rule has always tabulated expenditures for her business. She realizes that the same system she used for business accounting can be used for domestic purposes. This is an advantage of being a self-employed business owner. Mrs. Rule wants to be free of financial worry before her 65th birthday. Each time she tabulates, she tells herself she is reducing her fear of never being able to retire in comfort. Who has concern about their financial future? Not Mrs. Rule. Although she has an annual income of $90,000, she's worth more than 20 times that amount. And she is in control of her household's domestic spending. Robert and Judy, on the other hand, are frightened. And they should be. This couple earns $200,000 annually, or more than twice what Mrs. Rule earns. Yet, like so many of today's high-income-producing couples, Robert and Judy have only a fraction of Mrs. Rule's wealth. They feel that consumption controls them, not the other way around. Even Mrs. Rule might find it daunting to have to account for $200,000 in expenditures each year. Robert and Judy have 14 credit cards. The Rules have two, one for business use, the other for domestic spending. Let's talk about credit cards for a moment. Ask a large sample of millionaires a simple question about their credit cards. The results will give you an excellent idea of who these millionaires really are. Mr. or Mrs. Millionaire, please indicate by circling the appropriate number the credit cards that you or any member of your house possesses. Circle all of those that apply. Now close your eyes and pretend you're a millionaire with a net worth of nearly $4 million. What credit cards would be congruent with your station in life? Perhaps at the top of your list would be American Express Platinum, Diners Club, or Carte Blanche. Perhaps you consider yourself a fashion-sensitive millionaire. You may list credit cards from Brooks Brothers, Neiman Marcus, Saks Fifth Avenue, Lord & Taylor, or even Eddie Bauer. You would be in the minority of millionaires if you did list these cards. The results from our national survey of millionaires reveal some interesting credit card preferences. Some highlights. Like most American households, most wealthy households have a MasterCard and a Visa card. The millionaire household is four times more likely to hold a Sears card, 43%, than a Brooks Brothers card, 10%. Both Sears and Penney's cards are significantly more popular among the wealthy than the cards of status retailers. Only 21% of the wealthy households in America hold the Neiman Marcus card, 25% Saks Fifth Avenue, 25% Lord & Taylor, and only 8.1% the Eddie Bauer card. Only 6.2% of the millionaire respondents hold the American Express Platinum card, 3.4% hold Diners Club, and fewer than 1% own Carte Blanche. Question 3. Do you have a clearly defined set of daily, weekly, monthly, annual, and lifetime goals? The source of this question came from a decamillionaire whom we interviewed a dozen years ago. He told us that he started a wholesale food business at the age of 19. He never finished formal high school, but did eventually receive his high school equivalency diploma. We asked him to account for the fact that, although he was a high school dropout, he had accumulated over $10 million. His response was as follows. I have always been goal-oriented. I have a clearly defined set of daily goals, weekly goals, monthly goals, annual goals, and lifetime goals. I even have goals to go to the bathroom. I always tell our young executives that they must have goals. Mrs. Rule is goal-oriented. So are most other millionaires. For every 100 millionaires who answered no to this question, there are 180 who answered yes. Who are the no's? Many of the high-income and inherited wealth types discussed in the last section. Many senior citizens and retired millionaires who have already reached most of their goals also answered no. You may wish to reflect for a moment on the comments made by an 80-year-old multimillionaire. The first question we always ask is about goals. What are your current goals? Mr. Clark responded, "It was $438 an ounce yesterday in London." After Mr. Clark turned on his hearing aid, we repeated the question. "Oh, goals, not gold. I see, my goals. I've accomplished what I've tried to do. My long-range goal was, of course, to accumulate enough wealth so I can get out of business and enjoy life. I've been down the road. I've got an international reputation. Mine is one of the greatest welding companies in the world. I never want to retire, but now my goal is my family and self-satisfaction about what I've accomplished." Mr. Clark is typical of seniors who have accumulated significant wealth. By the way, only two millionaires of all those we interviewed ever told us that their goal was to spend my last dollar the day that I die. Neither Mr. Clark nor Mrs. Rule has such a goal. Mrs. Rule plans to leave educational trusts for all of her grandchildren. She also wants to enjoy life now and after she retires. She wants to be financially secure. Her financial goal is to accumulate $5 million. Mrs. Rule knows how much she needs to set aside each year to attain her goals. But is she happy? That's a question very often asked of us regarding frugal millionaires. Yes, she is happy. She is financially secure. Mrs. Rule enjoys being part of a close-knit family. Her family is everything to her. Her life and her goals are simple. Mrs. Rule does not need a CPA to do her goal planning for her, although she does seek his counsel in regard to both her domestic and business-related needs. But Robert and Judy, our high-income, low-net-worth couple, are in dire need of a strong and intelligent guiding hand. They need a CPA who has considerable experience in changing his clients' orientations, one who will help them change their household environment from one of chaos and hyper-consumption to one of goal-oriented planning, budgeting, and controlling. Will they then be happy? We don't know, but we can tell you this. Financially independent people are happier than those in their same income/age cohort who are not financially secure. Financially independent people seem to be better able to visualize the future benefits of defining their goals. Mrs. Rule, for instance, visualizes all her grandchildren graduating from college. She visualizes their success after college. She never sees herself being financially dependent on others, even if she is disabled in the future. Her goals are congruent with those of most millionaires in this regard. Question 4. Do you spend a lot of time planning your financial future? For every 100 millionaires who answer no, there are 192 who answer yes. Again, many who answer no are either high-income types with relatively low levels of accumulated wealth, those who inherited all or most of their wealth, or wealthy seniors or retirees. People such as Mrs. Rule accurately label themselves as planners. In fact, the responses to this question are highly correlated to the actual hours the respondents allocate to planning their financial futures. On average, millionaires spend significantly more hours per month studying and planning their future investment decisions, as well as managing their current investments, than high-income non-millionaires. The hours allocated to planning and managing finances will be detailed later. Millionaires like Mrs. Rule not only spend more time planning their finances than non-millionaires, they also seem to get more out of their planning hours. Remember, Mrs. Rule is not only in the auctioneering business. Her job includes appraising the value of what her company auctions. Often, Mrs. Rule invests in those same areas in which she has considerable expertise. In this regard, she is like many millionaires. They astutely allocate their time so that they can plan their business and personal investing at the same time. We often find that highly productive auctioneers are also excellent investors. Take, for example, an auctioneer who specializes in auctioning commercial real estate. What area of investments does he know a great deal about? Commercial real estate. He is his own investment analyst. What if your auctioneering specialty is antique furniture and American firearms? Should you invest in high-tech securities? Probably not. But you would be wise to use your expertise to help you make your investments. If you're well-versed in antiques, why not leverage your knowledge? You don't have to be an auctioneer to benefit from your knowledge. One of our associates was formerly the head of strategic planning at a major corporation. Part of his job was to study a wide variety of trends across a wide variety of business categories. Years ago, he discovered that the demand for investment-grade baseball cards would likely explode someday. This was long before the market reflected this trend. He invested heavily when the market was asleep, in his words. And he sold out all his holdings, including all his Mickey Mantle rookie cards, at the top of the market. Another acquaintance, a manager of a department store, always studied trade journals to learn how to make his store more productive. Later, he leveraged his reading habits into investing in growth stocks in the retailing area. How much time do non-millionaires allocate to planning and managing? Not enough. As previously stated, much less than millionaires. Although millionaires have much more experience in making investment decisions, they allocate significantly more hours than do non-millionaires in an effort to become even better investors. That is one of the main reasons that millionaires remain wealthy. Business owners like Mrs. Rule certainly have more freedom than people who are not self-employed. She can and does leverage her business knowledge with her personal investing habits. She can pick her area of business and the one she wants to study. Often employees don't have this luxury. But even among those who do have significant knowledge about excellent investment opportunities, many do not leverage this knowledge. Consider the following examples. A highly productive sales professional, we will call him Mr. Willis, had Walmart as a client for more than 10 years. All during this time, Walmart was exploding in growth and value. How many shares of Walmart did Mr. Willis, the six-figure earning sales professional, ever purchase? Zero. Yes, zero, even though he had considerable first-hand knowledge of his client's success and an annual six-figure income. But he did purchase a foreign luxury car every 2 years during this time. A high-income producing marketing manager, Mr. Peterson, was employed in the high-tech field. But he never invested a dollar in Microsoft or any other growth company. Never, in spite of having considerable knowledge about many of the firms in the technology industry. The owner of a printing business enjoyed having one of the leading beverage companies in America as a customer. The customer bought millions of dollars worth of printing from him annually. But how much money has the printer invested in his customer's equity offerings? Zero. In all three cases, the person makes a higher income than does Mrs. Rule. Yet none is a millionaire. In fact, Mr. Peterson, the marketing manager, has zero invested in stocks. He never invests any of his income, but he lives in a $400,000 home that is surrounded by others in the high-tech field who have big hats and bigger mortgages, but no cattle. Too many high-income, low-net-worth types live from paycheck to paycheck, fearing a sudden downturn in our economy. Our friend, the UAW. What motivates Theodore Teddy J. Friend? Why does he work so hard? Why is he driven to earn so much money? Why does he spend so much? Teddy will tell you it's because he's competitive. But so are almost all top-producing sales professionals. His competitiveness is not the most important reason for his behavior. When Teddy was growing up, his family was among the poorest in a blue-collar community. His family's small home was built from used lumber and similar discarded materials. Until Teddy was a freshman in high school, his father cut Teddy's hair, which did save money, although, according to Teddy, most people could tell that his head was worked on by an amateur. The public high school he attended attracted students from a wide variety of socioeconomic backgrounds. Many were from upscale homes. Rich kids were there in large enough numbers to fill the high school's parking lot with their nice cars. These cars always amazed Mr. Friend. Throughout high school, his family owned one automobile. It was a well-used Ford that his dad had bought when it was 10 years old. During his high school years, Mr. Friend made a promise to himself that someday he would be a lot better off than his parents. Better off, in his mind, meant having a nice home in an upscale neighborhood, fine clothes for everyone in his family, classy cars, club memberships, and items purchased in the best stores. Mr. Friend realized that better off could be achieved by finding a high-paying position and working very hard. Never did Mr. Friend equate better off with accumulating wealth. Again, being better off meant displaying one's high income via the conspicuous display of high-status artifacts. Teddy never gave much thought to the benefits of building an investment portfolio. To him, a high income was the way to overcome a feeling of social inferiority. A high income was the product of hard work. Income in the form of capital gains were foreign words to him. Mr. Friend's father and mother were dysfunctional when it came to putting money away for a rainy day. Their financial plan was very simple. They spent when they had money. They stopped spending when they ran short of money. If they needed something, such as a washing machine or a new roof, they saved for it. But they also bought many items with installment loans. They never owned any stocks or bonds. Never did Teddy's parents set aside income for investment purposes. They did not understand or trust the stock market. The only real financial wealth the couple had was a small pension and the equity in their very modest home. Today, their son has a need to compensate for his primitive blue-collar background and his perceived educational deficiency. Mr. Friend never completed college. Even now, he feels compelled to outperform all the college graduates against whom he competes. He will tell you that he enjoys dressing better, driving better, dwelling better, and in general, living higher than all those college kids who operate within his territory. Mr. Friend is the ultimate consumer. He has 2 boats, 1 jet ski, and 6 automobiles. 2 are leased, the others were purchased via credit. Interestingly, there are only 3 drivers in his household. He is a member of 2 country clubs and wears a watch that cost more than $5,000. He buys his clothes from the best stores. Mr. Friend also owns a vacation condo. Last year, Mr. Friend's income was approximately $221,000. Given his age, 48, what is his expected net worth? According to our wealth equation, his net worth should be $1,060,800. Expected wealth equals 1/10 of your age times your total annual income. What is his real net worth? Less than 1/4 of the expected figure. How is it possible that Mr. Friend has an actual net worth that is less than 1/4 of the expected value? The answer lies in how Mr. Friend thinks. Wealth accumulation is not what motivates him. Interestingly, Mr. Friend firmly believes that if he were really wealthy, he would not be a top income generator. He has often stated that people who come from wealthy backgrounds have little motivation to excel in the workplace. Mr. Friend has found a method to sustain and even enhance his drive to perform at high levels. He has found that fear is a great motivator. So he buys more and more via credit. By increasing the amount he owes, he correspondingly increases the accountant's fear of default. In turn, this increasing level of debt-based fear encourages him to work harder and more aggressively. To him, a big home is a reminder of a big mortgage and the need to perform at a high level. Mr. Friend is not a big spender across all categories of products and services. Ask him how much money he allocates for financial advice. In this category, he is very price sensitive. For example, his choice of an accountant was based almost exclusively on the accountant's fees, not on his quality. Mr. Friend has always believed that the quality of service that accountants deliver is about the same, only their fees are different. That's why he picked an accountant who has low fees. In sharp contrast, most wealthy people feel that you get what you pay for in the realm of financial advice. Mr. Friend spends a considerable amount of time working. Still, he constantly worries that he will lose his so-called competitive edge. He is concerned that his need to outperform the rich kids, the college graduates, will wane someday. Mr. Friend constantly reminds himself about his humble background and lack of that all-important college degree. He constantly punishes himself psychologically. In his eyes, he is inferior in pedigree to those very confident college graduates against whom he competes. He often wonders how they can be so content, given their less than exceptional performance in the workplace. Mr. Friend never really enjoys his life. He owns a lot of upscale things, yet he works so hard and for so many hours during a typical day that he has no time to enjoy them. He has no time for his family either. He leaves his house each day before dawn and rarely returns home in time for dinner. Would you like to be Mr. Friend? His lifestyle is appealing to many people. But if these people really understood Mr. Friend's inner workings, they might evaluate him differently. Mr. Friend is possessed by possessions. He works for things. His motivation and his thoughts are focused on the symbols of economic success. He constantly needs to convince others of this success. Unhappily, he has never convinced himself. In essence, he works, he earns, and he sacrifices to impress others. These factors underlie the thought processes of many under-accumulators of wealth. More often than not, UAWs allow significant others to determine their financial lifestyle. Interestingly, these significant others, or reference groups, turn out to be more imagined than real. Are you motivated by significant others? Perhaps you should consider a different approach to life. Perhaps you should reorient yourself. Are all high-income people who came from humble beginnings destined to become UAWs? Will they all turn out to follow the ways of Mr. Friend? Absolutely not. There is a fundamental reason beyond Mr. Friend's perceived social and educational deficiencies that explains why he became a UAW. His parents taught him the ways of the UAW. In spite of their modest income, his parents were not frugal. They spent nearly all their income. They were professionals in expending resources. Any pending increase in income was immediately earmarked for consumption. Even anticipated income tax refunds were allocated for consumption, long before the checks were received. Their consumer behavior had an impact on their son. They constantly sent him a message. One earns to spend. When you need to spend more, you need to earn more. Life among friends. How did Mr. Friend's parents spend their money? He told us that throughout their marriage they ate a lot, smoked a lot, drank a lot, and shopped a lot. Their household was always overloaded with food. They stockpiled snack foods, prime meats, cold cuts, ice creams, and other desserts. Even breakfast was a feast. Bacon, sausage, home fries, eggs, English muffins, and Danish pastries were basics in the morning. Steaks and roasts were the preferred dinner offerings. The friends never skipped a meal. Neighbors and relatives were frequent guests at the friends' restaurant, as they referred to their home. Mr. Friend's parents, between them, smoked about 3 packs of cigarettes a day. During a normal week, they consumed 2 cases of beer. On holidays, consumption of food, tobacco, and alcohol greatly increased. Shopping and consuming were the friends' main hobbies. More often than not, they shopped for fun, not necessity. On most Saturdays, they would shop from the early morning until mid-afternoon. First, they shopped for food. Then they spent countless hours shopping in discount stores. Mr. Friend pointed out that most of the stuff they bought was junk. His mother was an especially aggressive discount store shopper. She had a strong proclivity for purchasing large quantities of throw rugs, ashtrays, malted milk balls, caramel corn, towels of every color and style, casual shoes, wooden bowls, and cooking utensils. Many of these items were stockpiled, sometimes for years, before they were used. His father was also a recreational shopper. He spent hours each Saturday shopping for tools and hardware. In most cases, these items were rarely, if ever, used. Clearly, Mr. Friend's parents were UAWs. He was well-trained. But today, he generates a much higher income than his parents ever earned. Why is he still a UAW? This income in itself is a result of parental guidance. His dad often told him to seek a job with high income potential. To do so would enable Mr. Friend to buy the finer things in life. His father's message was clear. To purchase a fine home, luxury automobiles, and expensive clothing, one has to earn a large income. Mr. Friend found that several areas of the sales profession had excellent income-producing opportunities. He would have to earn big to spend big. No mention was ever made of the value of putting money aside for investing. Income was designed to be spent. Credit was used heavily for major purchases. Mr. Friend and his parents have never appreciated the benefits of accumulating wealth via investing. Mr. Friend told us repeatedly that it's hopeless. He just does not have any money to invest. How is it that someone with an income 6 times the average for American households has no money to invest? Mr. Friend spends more annually for his children's private school and college tuition than the average household earns in a year. He has an inventory of automobiles that is valued in excess of $130,000. He pays more than $12,000 each year for property taxes. His total annual mortgage payments are in excess of $30,000. Several of his suits cost $1,200 each. But his insensitivity to the benefits of investing go beyond his need to consume. His parents had no understanding or appreciation of invested dollars. Nor does he. And his parents passed this lack of wisdom on to him. Mr. Friend argues that his parents were people of modest means, people with no money to invest. Let's examine this perception. His parents smoked 3 packs of cigarettes each day. How many packs did they consume during their adult lifetimes? There are 365 days in a year, so they consumed approximately 1,095 packs per year. They smoked for approximately 46 years. So in 46 years, they smoked 50,370 packs of cigarettes. How much did the couple pay for these cigarettes? Approximately $33,190, more than the purchase price of their home. They never considered how much it cost to purchase cigarettes. They viewed such purchases as small expenses. But small expenses become big expenses over time. Small amounts invested periodically also become large investments over time. What if the friends had invested their cigarette money in the stock market, such as an index fund, during their lifetimes? How much would it have been worth? Nearly $100,000. And what if they had used their cigarette money to purchase shares in a tobacco company? What if they had purchased, reinvested all dividends, and never sold shares in Philip Morris instead of smoking Philip Morris products for 46 years? At the end of 46 years, the couple would have had a tobacco portfolio worth over $2 million. But the couple, like their son, never imagined that small change could be transformed into significant wealth. This change in behavior alone would have placed the friends in the millionaire category. They would have been members of the PAW group too, given their modest income. Perhaps they would have lived differently if someone had educated them about the mathematics of wealth appreciation. No one told them about this phenomenon. So it is not surprising that they failed to educate their son about the benefits of investing. But they did tell him not to smoke. His dad told him, "Don't ever put the first cigarette in your mouth. I'm hooked. There's nothing I can do to quit." His son followed this advice. Kicking the UAW habit. How long will Mr. Friend be able to fund his lifestyle? What if he were to stop working today? How long could he live off his current level of wealth? Only for about a year. No wonder he works so hard. Given his current circumstances, Mr. Friend will never be able to retire in comfort. In spite of being nearly 50 years of age, he has yet to figure this out for himself. But all is not hopeless. Mr. Friend can still become an accumulator of wealth. We find that it is often useful for UAWs to be told the naked truth. Friend, you're worth less than one half of the expected amount for those in your income/age group. Such news can spur on UAWs who are competitive. How do they respond when told that their net worth places them in the bottom quartile for all people with similar income and age characteristics? Some are incredulous. Many want to change but are uncertain how to transform themselves. How can someone change when they have more than 20 years' experience as a UAW? First, they must really want to change. Second, they will likely need some professional help. Ideally, they need to find a certified public accountant who provides financial planning. A professional of this type should have considerable experience and success with transforming UAWs. That is, they should have a strong track record in helping the Mr. Friends of the world become more PAW-like. In extreme cases, a CPA or financial planner actually takes control of his client's purchasing behavior. He first audits the client's consumption habits over the past 2 years. He categorizes and tabulates each element. Then the accountant consults with the client. The client is put into a cold turkey cutback program, meaning that all elements of consumption are reduced by a minimum of 15% for the next year or two. Additional cutbacks follow. In some situations, the accountant or financial planner even keeps his client's checkbooks, writes all the checks, and pays all the bills. Cold turkey is not easy for most UAWs, but sometimes it's the only way to solve the problem. The ultimate consumption category. The typical millionaire in our surveys has a total annual realized income of less than 7% of his wealth. This means that less than 7% of his wealth is subject to some form of income tax. In our latest study of millionaires, the percentage was found to be 6.7%. Millionaires know that the more they spend, the more income they must realize. The more they realize, the more they must allocate for income taxes. So millionaires and those who will likely become affluent in the future adhere to an important rule. To build wealth, minimize your realized income and maximize your unrealized income. Income tax is the single largest annual expenditure for most households. It is tax on income, not on wealth, and not on the appreciation of wealth if this appreciation is not realized. That is, if it does not generate a cash flow. What is the message? Even many high-income-producing households are asset-poor. One reason is that they maximize their realized incomes, often to support high-consumption lifestyles. Such people might wish to ask themselves a simple question. Could I live on the equivalent of 6.7% of my wealth? It takes much discipline to become affluent. We have interviewed many people worth $2 or $3 million who have total realized annual household incomes of less than $80,000. How much does the typical American household realize in income each year? About $35,000 to $40,000, or nearly the equivalent of 90% of its net worth. The result is that the typical household in America pays the equivalent of more than 10% of its wealth in income taxes each year. How about the millionaires whom we surveyed? On average, their annual income tax bill is an amount equal to only a bit over 2% of their wealth. That is one of the reasons they remain financially independent. Case study, Sharon and Barbara. Sharon is a high-income producing healthcare specialist. She recently asked us, "How is it that I make so much in terms of income but accumulate so little in terms of wealth?" Last year, Sharon's household had a realized total annual income of approximately $220,000, which places her household in the top 1% of all households in America. Sharon's household has a net worth of approximately $370,000. While Sharon's income is higher than 99% of the other households in America, her net worth is far below what it should be. Given her age, 51, and her income, $220,000, Sharon should, according to the wealth equation, expected net worth equals 1/10 of your age times your income, be worth approximately $1,122,000. Why is Sharon's level of accumulated wealth far below the norm? Because her realized or taxable income is too high. Last year, she paid $69,440 in federal tax on her $220,000 income. This is the equivalent of 18.8% of her total wealth. Yogi Berra might say, "Sharon, you can't be wealthy. Your income is too high." We believe that the average person in Sharon's income/age category pays the equivalent of only 6.2% of his wealth in annual federal tax, or $69,440 divided by $1,122,000. Thus, Sharon's tax equivalent, 18.8% of her wealth, is 3 times higher than the tax equivalent for the average person in her income/age category. To view this another way, Sharon has an annual realized income that is equivalent to 59.5% of her total net worth of $370,000. How could anyone hope to become truly wealthy when the equivalent of nearly 60% of her wealth is subject to income tax each year? The average person in Sharon's income/age category realizes the equivalent of only 19.6% of his net worth in annual income. Thus, only about $1 in $5 of his net worth is subject to income tax. What about people who have above average levels of wealth? How much of their equivalent net worth is being taxed? Barbara is a typical member of the PAW category. Her realized annual income is approximately the same as Sharon's, $220,000. But Barbara's net worth is approximately $3,550,000. Therefore, the equivalent of only 6.2% of her wealth is subject to federal income tax. What percentage of Barbara's wealth is paid in federal income tax? Approximately 2%. In sharp contrast, Sharon paid the equivalent of 18.8% of her wealth in federal income tax, or more than 9 times the percentage for Barbara. The average American millionaire realizes significantly less than 10% of his net worth in annual income. In spite of having considerable wealth and substantial annual increases in wealth in unrealized form, the typical American millionaire may personally be cash poor. More than 20% of Barbara's annual realized income is invested in financial assets that tend to appreciate in value without generating realized income. Sharon, on the other hand, invests less than 3% of her realized income. Most of her financial assets are in liquid form. Sharon's economic situation is quite risky. She is the main breadwinner in her household,